So this week on Talk on to Walk on, Patrick, we've got the fabulous Donna Scully. The reason I was so drawn to Donna, don't let it put you off. We are both lawyers. Obviously, Donna is still practicing with her fabulous company of carpenters alongside her husband, John. But the reason I was drawn to Donna was because of her story and her positive, fabulous Irish energy and the fact that she gets on her soapbox about social justice and fans supporting food banks, and she really gets involved and champions the underdog. She's got a wonderful story. Like I said, she got into the law in a very unconventional way, a lot more popular these days, but back in our day, Donna became a lawyer through actually not even going to university. So I can't wait to share her story. And can't wait to hear what she's got to say about that tenacity and all those challenges and that incredible mindset that I know that she needed to draw on to get there. So is there anything that jumps out at you from that?
Well, I do know that she, for quite a bit of her career, she worked with her husband, didn't she? So I wouldn't mind talking to her about that, because obviously very relevant for the two of us.
Yeah,
actually, and the ins and outs and trials and tribulations and that sort of
24 or 5 years, maybe longer. I think they've been working together. So there's testament for when people say never work with your husband, wife, kids, dogs, cats, whatever. They're actually probably a great example of it being successful. Or maybe she'll tell us otherwise. Who knows?
We'll see.
We will see. So let's talk on to Walk On with Donna and let's see where it leads. So I'm going to officially welcome you now to Donna Scully to Talk On to Walk On. The reason I was so drawn, well, there's a few reasons actually. Obviously, the familiarity of both female lawyers qualifying around the same time when I did a little bit of digging. Also, that fabulous Irish energy that you have and your vocalism on Twitter. I totally admire you for that, because I'm a bit of a wuss on there. But where I want to start is your story and how you got into the law in this very unconventional way. And I'm going to start by saying most people have a holiday romance and then it disappears. Yeah. You changed your life on the back of yours.
Yeah.
I want to know. What happened?
I did. And it's funny when I tell the story, and you know, only when I start to tell the story now, you get a bit older and a bit like more well known, and people want to know where you've come from. And I suppose I've become a bit more confident to say where I come from and what I've done. But yeah, that little bit lurks there, you know. And I go, yeah, well, I went to Torremolinas when I was 19, and I met a Geordie, and a year later I emigrated to Newcastle. And I think, you know, it's mad, isn't it? And I was thinking about you today, and I was thinking that the people who help you to get where you are. And, you know, I worked with a girl, and I'm still friends, still in touch with her, but I worked with a girl from Cork in Dublin, and I was a legal secretary in Fitzwilliam Square. And I said to her, she knew I was having this romance. He came over a couple of times, I went over there, and then he asked me to move over, you know, and I said to Liz, and she's quite sensible, she was a bit older than me, and I said to her, you know, he asked me, she went, go on, why don't you? And I went, really? She went, oh, you know. And I think someone like that, and I didn't know where it was, I didn't know where Newcastle was, so she took me to the library, because it's before the internet, and she showed me on the map where Newcastle was, and I said, Jesus, it's nearly in Scotland, you know, it's going to be freezing. But I literally got a return ticket on Dan Air for a month, and that was kind of like, you're right, I was going for a month. And, you know, we wouldn't work out. And obviously, over 30 years later, I'm still here in England. So, yeah.
That's absolutely...
Romance didn't work out in the end, but we were together for a long time.
So you were already a legal secretary in Ireland.
Yeah.
You left school at 16. So how did that come about? Tell me a little bit about your upbringing and school.
Yeah. So I left school at 16. I'm from Dublin inner city. So my dad died when I was 7, and we moved in with my granny and granddad, and they kind of took care of us with my mom, who suffers from mental illness. She's always been sick. So, you know, they kind of became my stability, my brother and I. And I went to a local school, Catholic convent school, early on, and then another one, which was a bit bigger and a bit more scary. And you know what? The nuns, I mean, I kind of along the line kind of was told I had some intelligence, and I met a teacher once. We had a lay teacher and she was great, Mrs. Whelan, and she kind of saw something in me and made my granny buy some encyclopedias because that was going to make me, I don't know what I was going to do with them, but anyway, I did read them. But so the nuns weren't really, didn't really instill ambition in you, you know. No. I mean, the only science I did at school was domestic science, which was cooking, sewing, knitting, you know, and I can't do any of those things, so they clearly failed on every level because I'm terrible at all of those things. But you know, there was no ambition, and also I come from a, you know, a very basic background, so your family are kind of dying for you to go to work, yes, and to hand up some money and make life easier. So I, you know, 16, and I just thought, and I thought I knew everything at 16, you know, as you do, and you've no guidance really. So I left school, well, I finished at kind of GCSE equivalent, but my granny made me do a secretarial course for a year, and our school did it, you know, that carriage return, and you're all sitting there with your manual typewriters. That was me.
So the Pittman or something, wasn't it?
I think Pittman shorthand, I think. Yes, I learned that, right, I didn't learn it because I don't know it. I learned bookkeeping that I don't know. I don't seem to have taken much in at all at school, but you know, and then I just went and got, I happened to get an office junior job in a legal company, you know, a law firm in Dublin.
Yeah.
And then a secretary job came up in Fitzwilliam Square when I was about 18. And I just went for it. And I just got a guy who interviewed me who just kind of liked me, maybe not for the right reasons or whatever, but anyway, gave me the job and gave me the chance. So I kind of got a job above my ability or my qualification, but it was kind of a stepping stone then. I was a legal secretary, so I earned better money. And to be honest, where I come from, that's a fantastic job. That's kind of like you've made it. But, you know, obviously then I emigrated and I became a legal secretary in England as well. So that was, you know, it is those things, isn't it? I always talk about luck and people go, well, it is hard work. And I go, but it's a bit of luck as well. You know, if I hadn't got an office junior job in a law firm, would I have become a lawyer?
But if you hadn't have gone for it either. Yeah. I mean, some kids might not have gone, oh, law, oh, I'm not going there, you know. And so that's why I'm sort of slightly intrigued about that. There's clearly, obviously, you've got the issue, your dad passing away then. We won't delve into that, but that's really an impact. Your mum having her mental health issues is an impact. You're brought up by your grandparents. All these things, I'm guessing, built your resilience, I'm guessing, and a bit of tenacity in there and feistiness. Am I right?
Yeah, I think so, because I you know, when I look at it and I do a bit of mentoring and I do some volunteering, and I see people with fractured backgrounds, and I talk about, you know, that fractured childhood where you haven't got stability or you haven't got that kind of nurture that you need. And I mean, I did have, but it was still a bit fractured. It was still a bit different because being brought up by your granny and granddad is not normal. So when I went to your parents' evening, my granny was a lot older, and you know, so but I kind of, you know, you just kind of get on with it. And I think I was lucky because there was nurture and there was some structure there. But yeah, I think it kind of, I suppose I did spoke on resilience a couple of years ago at a women's conference, and you know, we know what resilience is and we kind of understand, we think we understand it. But then I started to look at some TED Talks and, you know, research it, because I like to prepare if I'm doing something. So, and I looked at it and I went, God, because I was like, are you born with resilience or can you learn it? And I think there's a bit of both. Yeah. I think you can learn it and you can kind of, you know, help yourself to get it and to work at it. But I do think I'm probably, a little bit resilient naturally. And I, you know, the other thing I think as well is I have a very wicked sense of humour. And honestly, I think that gets you through a lot of crap, you know, really, you know, because I look at it and go, it's that bad, you have to laugh.
Yeah.
Dust yourself down, have a glass of wine and carry on. So I think that does help me. And that if that's resilience, then that does help me, definitely.
Yeah, I love that. And it's about making that choice, isn't it? Because, you know, some people could go, oh, I have a fractured background and do the sort of self-pitying side of it. And we all have those moments, but the key is not to stay there, isn't it? It's like, what am I going to do about it? And you knew you wanted more, didn't you? I can tell that.
Yeah.
And when your friend says, off you go, go on, just do it. You were like, oh, okay. You know.
Yeah. I mean, I do look back and think, what was I thinking? But the thing is, I wasn't thinking. And one of the things I've realised over the years, and a lot of my friends say this to me, you know, I never look back. I'm very much a forward thinker. So, like, I moved from Newcastle to London and then London to Merseyside. And each time, so I remember when I left London and my London friends came up to visit me, and you can imagine London friends, I was living in Wallasey in a pebble-dashed house, and they came to see it, and they were like, it was like, you know, wow, look at this, you know, because I was living in Ladbroke Grove in London, and it was like quite trendy, and they were like, whoa, this is different, whoa, yeah. You know, and I was like, yeah, yeah, you know, but it was obviously bigger. I was in a flat in London, and they said to me, you know, you're going to make this work, though. You're going to make this work. And I was like, how do you know? I've only been here a few weeks. They went, no, that's what you do. You're going to make this work. You're not going to come back to London. Because I said, I always say to myself, if I don't like it, I'm going back. So when I left Dublin, I went, I'm going back if I don't like Newcastle. I'm going back. So I always give myself the out. Yeah. But I haven't taken the out
never
yet.
Taken it. I love it.
No, no. Because I think I do work quite hard at settling in and making it work and trying to see. And each time it's been an opportunity for me to do more, to learn more, to be more. So I kind of, I've taken that, you know, it's a bit scary, but in another way, it's exciting. So yeah, I think I do like that kind of push, I suppose.
Yeah, I love that. And there's so many directions I could take you in, but let's bring you back to Newcastle and that moment where you then go, actually, I want more than being legal secretary. I want that.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment? Do you remember feeling that way?
Yeah, I do. Because I worked for a guy there. I was Lewis, and I was his legal secretary, his PA. I did everything for him. I booked his holidays. I put his dry cleaning in. I bought his hair dye. You know, I did everything for him. I looked after him. And I obviously did his work as well and looked after his clients.
I was about to say, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I hope he's not going to hear this about the hair dye. But anyway, he didn't like it anyway. I was trying to force him to do the hair dye. He didn't like it. So he didn't do it. But I, you know, and then you're like, you're being told what to do all the time. And I was like, I'm bored. You know, I want to be seeing my own clients. I want to be learning more. It was, you know, I kind of did it for a year and I thought, I can't just stay doing his dry cleaning and booking his hot. It's not for me. So the legal exec course, someone told me about that. And I think that's when I kind of thought, God, this place is brilliant. England's great, isn't it? Because in Ireland, it would have been more elitist. You know, there's no way someone who has GCSE only could study law. And I was like, wow, I could be a lawyer. You know, I did look and think it was going to take ages, but I still thought I could though. So I'm going to give it a go. And again, I do that thing where I did the first year and thought, if I hate it, I'm not doing the second year.
Yeah.
And then next thing you're 7 or 8 years in and you're there. So that's kind of how it came about.
But isn't it interesting because it's what you're exposed to, isn't it? And what you expose yourself to. So it's funny how I ended up in a sort of similar route. My brother was a barrister's clerk from the old YTS scheme.
Yeah.
He ended up in a barrister's chambers. And I was watching him going, oh, I love a bit of that. And we will come on to LA Law because I've heard you mention it. And that's all the time you're like, oh. And I just thought, oh, well, I'll do that. You know, I'll do what he does. But I just kept studying and kept going. And suddenly I find myself where I was. And you were saying, you know, you were because you did legal secretary and then somebody told you about the course again. I didn't even know that existed till I actually ended up in a law firm. And I was like, what's a legal exec? You know, unless somebody tell now, there's so much information, we're overwhelmed with it. Yeah. Whereas when we were, and good and bad outcomes from that, really. You know, you needed somebody to point you in the right direction or expose you to opportunities, didn't you? Because if you didn't know, you didn't know.
It's really, really why I love mentoring and why I want to do as much mentoring as I can, particularly people from my background, because that's what you realise you miss is that network.
Yes.
It's that, I mean, you know, there's no one in your family who's done it. You know, people almost laugh at you. I mean, the nuns were only interested if I got married, not if I became a lawyer. You know, there was no career guidance at school or anything. So, yeah, you're right. And, you know, it took me going out of my comfort zone, going off and, you know, seeking more and then hearing about these opportunities. And that's why I was really like, I was so pleased to know that I had that opportunity. Even though I'd messed up and left school at 16, I thought I was going to be stuck with that. And then all of a sudden hearing, oh no, there's an opportunity here for people who haven't got a lot of money, you know? And I thought, you know, that barrier is so achievable for people like me and social mobility, you know? And I just think I was just really delighted that I was going to have that opportunity and the rest was up to me then. If I, you know, was going to work hard, if I was going to, you know, take, do some tough stuff over the years to get there.
Yeah, Because you do have to give up a lot, don't you? I mean, again, you know, lawyers get a little bit of an eye roll sometimes about the profession or an accountant or whatever, but there's absolutely no doubt that you absolutely earn that qualification without a doubt.
That's why I'm so proud of it. You know, like
me too.
Even though I'm not really practicing as a lawyer now, because I'm involved in the business and other things, but I still relish that qualification because I never thought I'd get it, and it was available to me, and it was so bloody tough.
Yeah.
I worked. I mean, I had nightmares for years that they were making me do another law exam. You know, I sat down and worked out that 29 times I sat in an exam room and turned over a piece of paper 29 times to get qualified. So I think I had post-traumatic stress, you know, from all the studying and the exams. Yes. But yeah, someone said, do you want to do an MBA or something? I went, no, no more exams. No,
it's interesting.
Don't.
That's funny enough, that is my bad dream as well, is the exam. It's like, it is a bit of PTSD.
Oh, it's you don't forget. Even after all these years, I still, that, you know, the big clock on the wall,
yes,
and the invigilator, wherever you call it.
You can hear people turning the pages.
And desperate to see questions that you can answer. You know, that whole,
you read it too fast that you don't read it properly.
Well, I never read, that's my thing. And then, you know, I have to read it again and I realise I read it wrong. So that's a real bad thing I do.
Yeah, me too. It's very similar, but this is interesting. So, and yeah, it is something to be proud of. And again, when I packed in or whatever, it took me a while to, and I do put the LLB at the end of my name, but that took me a few years to actually start doing that because I was a bit I left the law after 10 years.
Yeah.
And I was a bit like, oh, not like a failure, but it took me a while to realise the reasons that I'd left it behind and still be proud of the fact that I actually did it. And all those learnings, without a doubt, I still use to this day. Those transformational skills, aren't they? They're transferable into so many different areas. And what I loved about it was that social mobility point, but actually from the opposite way around. Because I remember thinking that I went to Manchester and I made friends with all these people and it was a Christmas, all these big posh cars started turning up and I was like, oh God, they're all like, oh shit, they're all really quite wealthy. And I was like, and then I went, actually, would I have spoken to them if I'd have known where they were from compared to, do you know what I mean?
We wouldn't have met them, Michelle.
And now I never judge. I think that's one thing I always definitely try and do is not judge people.
No.
And there is quite a bit of that goes on. People will make a judgment about you with what you're wearing, where you're from, what you've got, how you speak. And I go, don't do it. Because some of my best friends are from all different cultures and backgrounds, you know.
And I met, you know, especially in London, I went to work in a big posh law firm in London and I met the best girls and I'm still friends with them. But I call them the Silver Spoon Girls because their life was absolutely so different from mine. But they were lovely and they were so posh and they come from, you know, well-to-do backgrounds and everything. And law was just automatic and they went to the best university. So they hadn't even heard of the legal exec course. So, but they were lovely and they were very supportive of me. And I used to say to them, and I'd say, I'm from a two up, two down, you know, a terraced house in Dublin. And they go, where did you all sleep? And I went, I can't remember, but we did. We all fit in somewhere. But, you know, I used to love those conversations. And I mean, I'm sure we mentioned imposter syndrome. I've had it, buckets full of it, obviously, because of my background and what I've done and everything. But they didn't make me feel like that. They kind of made me laugh at it and made me realise that. And they were very like, well, good on you. You know, the rest of us have had it all handed to us.
Yes.
But you're working your backside off. You're going for it.
And so it's a cross education, isn't it? Yeah. They're educating you about the world that they come from. And actually, they're all right. Yeah. You know, they're not people to have a go at and be like angry with or whatever. It's just the hand that life you're dealt, you know, in a way. And what you do with it is what matters. Again, I keep coming back to the word tenacity because for some reason I just keep... That's what I see and hear when I look at you and hear you speak. And there'll be a real admiration for that, you know.
And I think they're genuinely happy that I've done well and that, you know, because I think I'm the only one probably who's running my own business. And they're like, well, you know, you deserve it. And we were there, and they saw me. You know, they were there when they were going into town, and I was going to the library. And they were there on a Friday night when I couldn't get drunk because I couldn't have a hangover because I couldn't study on Saturday if I had a hangover. They were there when Mammy wasn't well and was ringing me 20 times a day because she was wanting me to come home and you know, things like that. And they were there. They were there for all of that. And they kind of go, you know, despite all that, you're here and you've done it and you've achieved it, you know, and they're delighted for me. And I think, you know, that kind of support is amazing. And those kind of people get you where you are. I mean, they carry you through those times, the tough times, to get you to the other side. But, you know, there's never a hint of jealousy or anything like that. It's just though, you know, that's brilliant and, you know, well done.
And another incredible decision from you, very brave. One again, I didn't take because that moved to London. But that again, huge step, Donna, to go from Dublin, Newcastle to London. What brought that about?
Well, the boyfriend, you know, the Torremolinos boy, Dean, he left a job in a factory and he became a photographer's assistant. So he was quite an ambitious person as well. So we kind of grew up together. So, you know, I was ambitious, he was ambitious. After 4.5 years there, I got a bit claustrophobic. I knew everybody because I'm Irish, you know, you stand out, and everybody knew me. And I kind of thought, again, I wanted more. And I just thought, you know, it'd be good for him, it'd be good for me. And it's like, I was always like, London's quite exciting, isn't it? And I just thought, and again, you see, I was going back to Newcastle if I didn't like it. So it was dead easy, you know. I had the out. So
Love it.
off me and him went, and we went on the National Express bus. We were so poor. And we got down to London, and a friend of mine put us on their floor in the attic for a few weeks while we found like a flat share. And yeah, it was just, I had him as well. I wasn't on my own, and I think that helped as well.
But another adventure, and I'm not being funny. Not only did you go there, you end up at Mishkondiraya. I was like,
Yeah.
what?
But you know what happened there is I went back to being a secretary, and luckily there was a woman there in the personal injury department. I was working for her, and she kind of realized that I'd done 2 years legal exec. She was from a very working class background, so she said, "This is not good enough. You've just studied for 2 years. We're loaded with work. You can be a trainee legal exec here." So she lobbied for me to be promoted to a trainee legal exec. So I got my foot in the door. Luckily, and here's another woman, another great, I'm not saying they're all women who are great, but another woman comes along and says, "That's not good enough. You know, you're working to try and do more." She could tell that I was able to do a bit more than typing. So.
And that's, I always remember when I was at Waitman's, and I remember them interviewing for trainees. I mean, I've got my own story on itself, as I literally photocopied and stamped a massive discovery case, you know, all the literally for 2 years stamping, photocopying, stamping, and knocking on the door going, training car, hello. I remember this walk down the fifth. You had to go, I was in the basement, you had to go up to the fifth floor, walk along. Hello, just is there any training contracts? Heart in your mouth, all that, you know.
Desperate.
But I remember when I got through it all, and then I would be, you'd sit with a partner and they you'd hear about them interviewing for trainees. And they said, you know, the key, and coming back to exactly what you just said, all the academic qualifications, but you have to be able to talk to people. You have to be able to communicate. You have to be able to pick up the phone. And again, it's very interesting. And I still think that potentially is a huge, is a bit of a problem in terms of, probably for different reasons in this day and age, given social media and heads down and whatever. Whereas, you know, in our day, we were probably a little bit more vocal and a little bit more feisty and given our backgrounds and relatable too, in a way.
And not afraid to ask, you know, like, you know, and I think, I do think, because I'd had that exposure, because I worked in a small legal aid firm, so I got a lot of experience in those 2 years. You know, probably way above what I should have been doing, but I, you know, it's a baptism of fire. But I came to London with quite a lot of client contact experience under my belt. But I think you're right, and I think that's where the legal exec course is good because you get quite practical experience as well as studying because you're working during the day and then you're going to school at night, or you might get day release if you're lucky. So you're kind of working and learning on the job, whereas you come out of university and you've probably never interviewed a client or, you know, other than pretending to. So I do think there's a lot of that practical experience is really good.
But at the time, like you come back to imposter syndrome, you don't realize how important that
No.
is.
No.
And then you have those moments, and again, I can totally relate, like you're going forward, going forward, going forward, head down, next step, what's next, what's next, what's next? And then suddenly you get so, and you go, oh,
Yeah.
what?
Yeah.
How did I get here? And
Yeah.
do I belong
Yeah.
here? And
Yeah.
again, my moment was a little bit when I got my training contract and I saw everybody else's sort of CV in the newsletter, and it was can speak X languages, plays the flute, plays the clarinet, loves, you know, travel,
Yeah.
theatre, all this kind of. And mine was socializing and aerobics.
James Bond, probably. Yeah, I know. But the thing is, when you're studying all the time and you're like, you know,
you
from
didn't
our
do
background,
anything.
You have no hobbies.
No, I know.
You didn't learn any instruments or, you know, I'm like, that's what people think about hobbies. I'm like, you know, what are they?
No, exactly. I'm just applauding you for that because I still struggle with that a little bit.
Yeah, me too. I say now, like, you know, I probably will still say socializing if I had to, and Pilates, you know, that's the list. You know, I don't garden. I don't do anything really. I mean, a volunteer, maybe I could put that now. But, you know, like, yeah, I have no, I've never been a good hobby girl. I've never been a good CV, you know, outside interest girl.
Because, again, we thought we had to be perfect, didn't we? And because we had that little bit of imposter syndrome, it's a terrible term, but it was almost like we have to work harder to get there. We have to do the extra to get there. We can't just pass. We want to smash it. You know, we want to prove ourselves. Funny enough, there's something going and doing the rounds on LinkedIn. I don't know if you saw about imposter syndrome, and it was one of these graduation ceremonies in the United States. And I can't remember the lady's name, but she was basically saying it's actually a distraction. It's a distraction because it's to the inequalities of life. That's what we should be tackling, the system that makes us feel that way, as opposed to you have to fix it yourself. You know?
I agree. I think for me, the only thing for me was I was obviously drowning in it and I didn't know what it was. And I thought it was just me. So the only thing I like about it being categorized and hearing a name for it was that it wasn't only me.
Yes.
And that it was other people, and also, like you say, those people with the great CVs, even they had it, because I thought it was just me because of my background, because I hadn't got a degree, because I didn't go to university, so I had all these reasons why I was so insecure and thought someone was going to find out that I wasn't good enough to be where I am and all that. So I quite like that idea that there was a name for it. But I agree with you. I did see that, you know, on LinkedIn, because, you know, I'm always on there. But what I did think was, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I also think in some ways, by talking about it, if someone had talked about it or I'd heard about it when I was young, I wouldn't have felt so isolated.
Yeah, it's a relatively new term, isn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't around.
It was more like something that you felt like you needed to hide and couldn't talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I remember somebody saying, I think I know who it was who said it to me, is in a review, Michelle needs to stop feeling ever so grateful to be here. And I sort of took it as a bit of a criticism instead of somebody just sitting down and saying, Michelle, you deserve this. I mean, I know that's what they meant, but I took that as just shut up about it now and get on with it. And I know they were trying to give me a touch and go, come on, just accept you are here. But actually, I could have just done with a bit of a hug and somebody actually saying, you're doing okay, girl, you know, keep going.
Yeah. And I think what they meant, what they probably meant, Michelle, was that you need to realise that you're good enough and that you're great for what you've achieved. But the thing is, when you're in the middle of that, I'm not good enough and they're going to find me out, you don't think like that. And I remember, like, I did a review once and, you know, it was like, look, and apparently I said look about 25 times in this, review. And the fella said to me at the end, he said, well, he said, Donna, you know, you must be the luckiest person who ever lived. I never met anyone luckier than you. And he was obviously being sarcastic. It was a guy I worked with in London. And I went, are you being sarcastic? He said, yes, of course I am. He said, you've worked your arse off. That's why you're here. He says, okay, there would have been a bit of luck. But he said, not 25 times luck. You know, and I was laughing, going, oh, okay. But he was being kind.
Yes.
But it is a bit like, whoa. You know, what I see what you mean, but it's quite hard to absorb that. And also, it's this thing when you come from our background, I think, about being big-headed. There's this terrible balance between, I don't want to be, you know, we call it in Dublin, losing the run of yourself. You know, you're not allowed to lose the run of yourself. You know, keep your feet on the ground. So you're brought up like that, and you're brought up in a very, and then you do good and you get a bit of success. So it's that thing where, okay, give yourself a pat on the back, but don't go too far about it. So it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to juggle that.
That balance. What I mean, a fabulous Lynn. Again, congratulate you on that whole London experience and that. I'm glad, but then Liverpool. I mean, again, what led to that?
Well, John, so you know my husband, who we have the business together. So I met John in London, and we worked together in London. And then he left London after a couple of years to go and set up his own small law firm. He was in a big law firm in Liverpool with a London office. So I worked for the London office. So when I was at Michicons, I got headhunted to this Liverpool firm opening because they, the trade union that they had at Michicons, went to the Liverpool firm. So I went, that's the work I liked. So they headhunted me and another woman. So I went to work in the London office, and John came down to run it, and the rest is history. But then he went back to set up, he left a big law firm in Liverpool. He wanted to set up on his own and do niche commercial stuff. So he literally set up over a kind of a conservatory business in Prenton while he was waiting on offices. So he literally started from London with just a few boxes of files. But he did that 27, no, sorry, 29 years ago this year. So we went back up to Liverpool, but we kept in touch, and we were still kind of seeing each other. And then 3 years later, I went to do my finals, my LPC full time. So I got sponsorship, and as part of my headhunted package, I asked for sponsorship to go to college for 10 months because I'd never been to university. And I
Great.
also got a bank loan, a student loan.
No, yeah.
Just before I hit 30, I got a student loan. So I went to, it was funny because it was Central of London Poly, but the year I went there, it became London Guildhall University. So I got to university in the end. So I could say, can't I now? Anyway, I went off there, and I was obviously one of the oldest people there on the course, but I loved it. And I did 10 months, rucksack on my back from Clapham into London Guildhall, went out with everybody on the course after, classes. So I was a student, I was a proper student for 10 months, no work, and I loved it. So, but then I qualified and I didn't go back to the firm there. You know, John had left. I didn't really want to go back. So I went to work at Geoffrey Green Russell in Bond Street. And that was my beginning of my motor person injury experience. And that's kind of where I've ended up in a motor area. But you laugh at this because I went for a job there, and I was a qualified solicitor. I qualified a few weeks before. I suppose I better go back one step because this is quite funny. So I finished the job, finished the course. Don't go back to the other firm, and I'm looking for a job. But in the meantime, I have to pay the bills. So I went to work at the British Medical Association as a legal secretary. So this is like while I'm waiting to qualify. So I'm a few days off qualifying. So I go there as a temporary secretary. Oh my God. And I'm the worst secretary that ever lived because by the time I haven't been a secretary for 20 years, and they've brought out computers now. I used to be on like an Olivetti. You know those with the little ball? So now I'm on a bloody computer and all that malarkey. No idea what to do with it. So I
Still
sit
see
down at the
all that
desk.
malarkey. What is all this?
All this technology. So, and like I didn't know how to print anything. I didn't know how to any. Anyway, I was awful. But I was quite good with clients on the phone. And the guy I was working for was kind of, he needed me to really kind of get the clients off his back. So I was there about 3 or 4 weeks. I didn't tell them obviously that I was a solicitor or that I was about to be a solicitor. I just didn't say anything. I'm a temp. And then when I was leaving, he offered me a job as a secretary permanently. Roger, I remember he was a lovely guy. And I said to him, no thanks, Roger. I don't want to be a secretary. I said, the whole last 10 years is about me not being a secretary. So I said, I'm going to be a solicitor and I've got a job in Bond Street. And he was laughing and he had a little leaving party for me in the library. So all these women who didn't know, who'd been bossing me around for weeks, it was as the
Oh,
junior secretary, but she's actually a solicitor, and I was like laughing, but it was a really good fun. But I went to this other firm for 3 years, and kind of worked my way up. When I went in, they didn't give me a secretary because I could type, so everyone else had a secretary except me. So I had to do my own typing and be a solicitor. Anyway, but quite a few senior people left in that department, so I kind of got elevated quite quickly to a higher level. And within 3 years, I got offered a partnership, and it was a really big pay rise. I did go and get drunk, with my flatmate and was like, oh my God, what do I do with all this money? I've been poor all my life, you know. So, but then I kind of looked at it and I went, I didn't like the ethos of the firm. It didn't really suit me. And then John said, well, why don't you move up here? Why don't you join me and set up like a personal injury department here? You know, in this little, I think we had two rooms and about six people. And I was like, really? And then I thought, oh, I don't know. I don't think so. But then he's, you know, he convinced me to have a try. And he said, better to try it. And then if you don't like it, you can do it. If you go to the job, you'll never leave it. Yeah. So anyway, another good person in my life who saw potential and thought I could do it.
Why me didn't you?
Yeah. Absolutely. So he got me to do it. And then that's 26 years ago this year. And now we're, you know, bigger and whatever. And now we're niche motor. So it worked out.
And how many staff have you do you have?
I think on over 1,200 now.
Yeah,
quite a lot, you know. And
the awards are, I know you're going to be modest about it. I mean, there's a plethora of awards that you've had, not only nationally but globally, and your contributions into your industry are off the scale from what I can see. You've definitely grabbed the bull by the horns and not just sat behind your desk, have you?
No, I think. I think I'm a campaigner by nature. I think, you know, I'm obviously not shy and I'm not shy about my opinion. I think when you work in an industry like mine, you know, there's a lot of in insurance and legal, there's a lot of stuff goes on. There's a lot of reform that goes on, you know, from government, from people who don't understand the industry. So I think from early on, I've wanted to kind of get engaged in that, have my say. And I have, and I think probably I like a soapbox. And I think that's in you. I think that's in me. I mean, you know, people say my dad was like that. Okay. You know, he was quite outgoing and quite, you know, opinionated and whatever. So I suspect that's where it's come from, a bit, that kind of DNA. His mum was like that. So I think that's the Scully DNA. And it kind of, look, people kind of say to me, you know, look what you've done and the awards that I've had and you know, whatever, the acknowledgement. But I've been doing it for 30 years and 26 years of carpenters. So I would say to women and young women and anybody, you know, you have to work at it and you have to be consistent and you have to keep fighting away, you know. And eventually, there's been loads of times over the years people haven't agreed with me, haven't supported me, didn't want to hear from me, you know, when you're a fly in the ointment. But I think just eventually, if you keep going and keep going, if you really believe in it, then, you know, it can work out. And it is kind of, it is a surprise. It's lovely, obviously. And nobody hates awards, but it's lovely in that way, because it kind of, it's an acknowledgement, isn't it, from your peers, from people around you, that even though you've been given out for a long time, they kind of understand why and they kind of get it now. And maybe it was for the best, but it's that thing, you know, about losing the run of yourself. You've got to be careful. You like it,
but you're,
you know, it's like, whoa, don't talk about it too much.
But also, not just from the industry recognition, from you know, for the fact that carpenters themselves, you know, they, in terms of diversity and culture and actually bringing in processes, which, you know, again, nothing against my former employees. It was just, it was the times that it was. But you had your twin boys, and I'm sure that must have made an impact on how you approached how you ran this business, surely?
Yeah. I think everything about me influences the business or influences my idea about the business. And John, you know, we're both from very working class backgrounds. Neither of us went to university. Neither of us have a degree between us. So I think it would be really weird of us not to be very strong about social mobility. It doesn't matter where you come from, it doesn't matter how you speak or anything, but we want you in the business and we want to give you a good chance in the business to do well. And I think in terms of gender, I mean, you know, that's one of my biggest and proudest things about the business. Because people say to me, how did you get 50-50? We're probably a bit more 50% women than men, but anyway. So how did you get there? And I go, do you know what? You know, it's just about flexibility. It's about best person for the job. It's about further training, you know, things like the legal exec course. You know, we've got, I think across the business, we've got over 25 apprentices, and apprenticeships are brilliant for people like me. You know, if I'd had an apprenticeship, a legal apprenticeship, that would have been great. I'd have loved that. And I think it's really important. And I, you know, some of the people in our business I mean, I'm an office junior. That's where I started. So I've done every job in the business. But I've
Yeah.
people in, who've come in the who second in command in finance who came in as an office junior. You know, we've a lot of people. We call them the lifers. I don't know if you've heard me talk about the lifers, but we've a lot of people over 20 years in the business, 15 years. You know, and I think, you know, they've all progressed, and some of them have had their families and come had time off, had part time, come back now full of beans. Kids are grown up. I want a career. I want to do well. I want to earn well. So I think it's just about building a business that you can be proud of and that is a reflection, I suppose, of your values.
Yeah.
And listen, Michelle, it's not perfect, and we haven't got
No.
everything perfect. There's still loads of stuff because at the end of the day, we still have to deliver. And like
Yeah.
any other business in the market, you know, it's pile them high. Everybody wants more for less.
Absolutely, but what you're creating is a culture of loyalty, and you know, certainly I'm guessing amongst the majority of your staff, they want to do the best for the business because you're treating them well, you know,
Yeah.
it comes back.
I think so. It's a team effort. I mean, it
Yeah.
sounds really cheesy. I sound like I'm, you know, some
No, not at
American
all. Not at
thingy,
all.
but it is a culture, and we work together, and like we go through tough times. We've been through some tough times, obviously with the pandemic, and then we had some major reforms in our market, which were horrible the last 2 years. But we've worked together, and we've all pitched in, and you really appreciate that. You know, that's what you need. You know, I mean, and but we do a lot of communication. So, you know, even over the last 2 years, we were very open with everybody. This is really tough. It's going to be very tough for a few, you know, a year or so, but we're going to get through it, and we're going to build it and make it better, which we have done, and we've come out the other side. But we did it together, and I think that communication piece is worth it as well, you know, because then you do feel like you're on the team, don't you? And that we care about each other.
You have a sense of ownership of the business yourself, regardless what position you are in. You know,
Yes.
you are carpenter, you open you up. I'm
Yes.
sure they're probably and you know what, my old firm did have a bit of that, but it just they grew so rapidly that they
Yeah.
definitely they will acknowledge that the people who are
Yeah.
probably half of them are retiring now. But you
Yeah.
know, they definitely took their eye off the ball when it came to looking after those who were there. It was just all about growth, rapid growth.
Yeah.
And some few of them lying in their pockets along the way. And you know,
Yeah.
a lot of people fell by the wayside. And I was definitely one of those. And but again, another fascinating conversation that we could go into. But where I want to come back to, and I might bring Patrick in on this, is you and John. So can
All
I bring
right.
Patrick in on this?
Oh, he'll kill me. You know, he's really low profile.
I know, but
The
we've
opposite to me, but yeah, he'll kill me. But I don't care because he won't listen to this. He never listens to me speaking. It makes him too nervous. So I can say whatever I like.
There you go, Patrick.
Yeah.
And I'll leave you to ask the question because the instinct for me is about those conversations and how the hell have they managed to pull this off for 25, 30 years.
Cool. Hi
Working
again, John.
together.
It's great that you say that John won't be listening, so I can ask you whatever I like, and you can
Say
answer
anything you like about me
anything
now.
you want to ask. Anyway, Donna. So Michelle and I are quite compared to your 29, 30 years, Michelle and I are quite early on in our working together phase. So what a couple of questions. One, how did that work between you and John? Does it work with you in terms of the way you've successfully worked together because you complement each other by your differences, or are you both quite similar people? Are you very, very different characters, or are you both very similar? And you can't say in the middle.
No,
I'd like a black and white answer.
there is no middle. No, there's a really, no, we're massively aligned and together in terms of the major things like culture, how the business will look, the feel of it, how we're going to treat people. So all of those things are really, we're easy from the beginning, and we're still very aligned. We never disagree on treating people a certain way or our culture or our integrity. Or, you know, he's got a lot of integrity, John, and I love that, and it's been very good to work with somebody like that. But I think where we go right off is personality. Is he's very measured, and he's very thoughtful. So he does the finances, and you know the balance. I wouldn't even know which end to hold the balance sheet up if you asked me. If you said to me today, "What's our turnover? What's our profit?" I wouldn't know any of that. I've no idea of any of that. But I love people and processes and technology. I mean, I can't even do it, but I know I need it, and I know who to get in to get it. And so we definitely have completely different interests in terms of the business. And we made this thing early on in the business, really from very early. We said two things was, if it was my area and we weren't aligned, I would make the decision. And if it was his area, he would make the decision. And there would be no, I told you so. So we're going to have a no blame culture between me and him. Now, the reality is, I've thought I told you so about a million times about him, and he has about me, but we just don't voice it, and we let it go, because it's toxic. It would be terrible. But other than that, yeah, I think it's our differences. And he's very like, he lets me go. I mean, I laugh, and this is bad, I suppose, in some ways, some people would say, but I've no filter. He's my only filter, and he doesn't filter me. He'd say to me, don't be a nasty person, or don't be rude, or don't be have bad manners, or don't go on social media and be, fighting with everybody like an idiot. But in terms of having an opinion and that, he's fine. And he knows I do, even though he doesn't listen to me. He knows, because people say when we meet, oh, I follow you on Twitter. Oh my God, and he closes his eyes up to heaven because he's heard it so many times. So he knows.
Yeah.
I
I love
love it.
Come on, Patrick.
I love that because it does sound very, very similar to
Yeah.
Michelle and I. So we've got like I say, we're very early on in our working together, and it looks like at least we've got one ingredient right there in terms of our differences there.
Yeah. I think, sorry, another one is respect. I would say that's the massive thing that we have for each other. I
Yeah.
think he's absolutely brilliant, and he seems to think I'm not bad. So, but there is that massive respect, and I think we both know that if we make a decision, we make it in good faith. So it's our best shot, and we mean well. So but I do think that respect thing. Although we obviously love each other, that goes without saying. But I think that respect thing
Yeah.
is when you work together as well, is very important, because there's so many flashpoints and so many difficulties along the way. I think as well, what seems to work as well, I don't know if you have this, when I have a wobble, he seems to be all right. When he has a wobble, I seem to be all right. So I don't know whether we know we can't wobble at the same time, but
Yeah,
we take turns to wobble, and that seems to work.
and obviously, you obviously have a great connection and you communicate with each other. That's so coming back to the whole conversation and being open and honest and saying how you're feeling. I mean, again, there's a hint of sometimes you want to go and say, I told you so, but you choose to hold that back. And that's actually quite interesting that you go, I've just got to learn to let go. Because often we say how you're feeling, but sometimes there's a time not to say it as well, isn't there?
I agree. And I think that respect stops you saying it, because there's no point. And the thing is, John and I are both very driven and very competitive. So I already know I've messed up, and he already knows. So you don't need someone to tell you, because you're already beating yourself up anyway. So yeah, and I think those kind of rules early on help. We do laugh about it because we do think it, even if we don't say it. But I think those kind of boundaries, and a lot of people say to me, my friends think it's crazy. I mean, you must get it. You work together. I mean, but it just has worked really well, and you kind of make it work. And then in other ways, you get to spend a lot of time together in a positive way, because otherwise you would be apart quite a lot, especially a few years ago, because I was traveling a lot and I was doing more speaking and all that kind of stuff. So we wouldn't have seen each other as much, which would have been hard. So anyway.
But when you, Donna, when you describe John as being quite measured, I think I'm right, and I think I read somewhere about you in terms of you can switch off. You've managed to, and sort of, I use the word compartmentalize, but then the more I Google compartmentalize, there's a lot of sort of psychology attached to it, which isn't always good in terms of an ability to compartmentalize. But that's something that I find as a coping strategy I use quite a lot if there are certain things that I just need to switch off from, so I can be dealing with something else that's more pressing or urgent at the time. So that was
I
I'm
can
not
I can do that.
saying
Yeah. John can't do that.
that.
He is compulsive thinker, worrier, intense. He finds that very hard. I mean, he can have fun, but he's much more it's much easier for me to do that. And you know, when before we had the boys, we worked 7 days a week, you know, building up the business. And then when I had the boys, and I said, just so you know, I won't be working on a Saturday and Sunday anymore. I said, come Friday night, I'm going to pick them up on a Friday lunchtime, and that's me till Monday. Don't talk about work to me over the weekend, because I'm going to be very tied up with the boys. You know, and he's like, what? You know, because he's this person. But, you know, and yeah. I used to laugh on a Monday morning on the way into work. All this stuff would come out of his mouth that he'd obviously bottled up for two and a half days. But I just felt like, for me, I mean, one, to be a good mammy, and two, you know, to survive that kind of pressure. I need it. I put it down to being Irish. I don't know if it is that reason, but, you know, we're kind of party animals by nature. So I kind of go, you know, I've done my 4.5 days work, and sometimes it was overnights and everything, and it was a lot of hours. And now, you know, I don't want to. I mean, I've said this before, and it sounds quite derogatory, but it was funny, and he meant it in a funny way, because he doesn't do anything like that. But he used to say to me on a Friday lunchtime, I'd pull out the drawer, put my brain in the drawer, shut the drawer, go off and get the boys, and then just go mad for the weekend, you know, rugby, football, drinking, and then come back in on Monday, like, take the drawer out, brains back in. But I think the other thing is, I'm quite good at time management. So if I'm working, if I do 2 hours, it's solid 2 hours. And, you know, if I know I only have 4.5 days, I'll get loads into that time so that I can have the time off. So, yeah, I do think I'm good. And it helps as well, because I suppose I help him a bit, because that intensity is tough. It's very wearing, isn't it? And it can wear you down. But yeah, I have that thing where I can switch off. I mean, I suppose I don't switch off 100%. And if I wake at 3 a.m, like everybody else, things will go through my head, but I'll just kind of bat them away. You know, because, and I think as well that work is great, and it's given me a great life, and hopefully it's created a good business. But, you know, your quality of life is important as well, isn't it? I mean, the boys are 22 now. So if I hadn't had those 2.5 days,
yeah,
you know, I'd be kind of probably regretting it now. Yeah. And I wasn't there all the time, and I wasn't the perfect mammy by any accounts, but I did put time aside, and I tried to be present when I was there with them, because I thought, you know, I'm not there all the time, so the time I'm there, I'm really going to be there. I mean, I used to have two work phones, so I'd put my BlackBerry in the drawer with the brain, and I'd have my normal phone, so, because I wouldn't look at emails, because you didn't used to get your emails on your normal phone, only your text. So, you know, yeah, those kind of things did help me to survive.
Well, the interesting thing is that there are clearly differences there, but they're all sort of complementing each other. But one thing that where there isn't a difference clearly, and you were talking about it before I came on, was this importance of working hard. And when you were talking about luck, I totally agree. You know, there are very few instances in life where it's literally down to luck. And it's a phrase that's bandied around. And I think that particularly younger people now, with the advent of social media and instant celebrity and so on, there's a certain idea that life isn't about hard work, when in reality it is. Yeah. And particularly, you know, young professionals, I think young professionals are potentially different. They know they've got to work hard. You've got to work hard to succeed.
No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, I do some mentoring. And one of the things I say to young people and to young women and to people in the business, there's no silver bullet. So they're looking at me going, give me the silver bullet. You know, give me that thing where all I've got to do is that and I'll be where you are. And I go, it has taken years of hard work. It's taken of getting knockdowns and having to pick yourself up. I mean, I say this and John kind of disagrees with me, but I think for me, the thing I've needed most in running my own business and getting to here is courage.
Yeah.
He goes, no, it's not. It's ability. That's what. And I went, no. You know, that days when things go wrong, or, you know, the pandemic hits and everybody has to go home to work. And you really have to check how your IT is. You know, they need courage that day, because you've got to stand on as the owner. You've got to not show that you're afraid, you know. So I think for me, one of the things I've had to, maybe I have a bit of courage anyway, but I've had to learn that, you know, it's a really important trait, that, because it when the shit hits the fan, you really need to be able to stand on and pick yourself up.
And there's a link between courage and, going back to, resilience.
Yeah.
It's sort of the same thing, isn't it? It's not, if you get knocked down, it's getting back up quickly, not allowing yourself to be knocked down permanently.
Or to take it like it's the end. It's not the end, it's a learning curve. And I think for me, the one thing about nice about being older, and there's not many nice things about being older really, is that you are nicer to yourself. Because, you know, if I did something wrong in my 20s, jeepers, believers, it would be the end of the world. You know, like, oh, my God, nothing worse could happen to anybody. You know, whereas now, you know, and I have got this saying, I do say, wait, no, nobody died.
Yeah.
If there's nobody that you have to bury, it really isn't that bad. So, and I've really tried to instill that in the boys, you know, because I didn't have that. I did worry. And I do think if you come from a very basic background where, you know, money's been tight, where you've always had to work to pay the bills, and you've probably always been in debt a bit and stuff. It's that worry. If I mess up, then I might not have my job. I might not have the money to pay the bills. And that worry, you know, is debilitating. So I think now I try, and I do mess up, and I still mess up, and I still go, but now I'll just go, you know what? Have a glass of wine. You know, I'll speak to John. He's really good. Minute. If I say to John, this happened, it's terrible. He'll go, how is that terrible? And I think someone having your back like that and kind of stops you being ridiculous, that kind of helps as well, doesn't it, though? But yeah, just being a bit nicer to yourself.
Well, coming on to that, you talk about midlife. We're sort of one of our angles to the podcast, and the expanding of the brand is actually about midlife and that midlife mindset.
Yes.
What you've just said about being kinder to yourself, but what is it that you think we need to be doing as midlifers to keep that energy and passion alive and purpose in a way?
I think, I mean, for me, middle age, apart from you look terrible and you look worse, you actually are, it's more liberating. I think it's kind of been liberating in the sense that I think I've thought to myself, do you know what, Donna, this is you. So I've always been working on myself all my life, you know, about this is wrong with me. I need to learn that. I have to do that. And I'm still a work in progress. And I'm still, you know, I still listen to Brené Brown when I'm walking and things like that. So I'm not saying that I'm the finished article, but I kind of go, the things I don't like about myself or that I don't think are right, I kind of go, well, what makes me good makes me bad and vice versa. So you have to like me as I am, and I'm doing my best, and I'm not trying to be mean. And I'm trying, and I will get things wrong. So I think that I like that bit where I'm a bit more liberated, and I'm not like, and I'm not saying I don't worry what people think of me, but I worry less. Yes. And again, that's quite liberating. So I think that is the middle age. You know, I wish I could be in this relaxed and this kind of myself 30 years ago, but I just didn't have the tools. Yeah. I didn't have the courage, you'd be like, I didn't believe in myself. And I don't want to sit here and say that I believe in myself all the way, but I kind of go, this is me. And I know people go, being yourself, and I say this when I'm mentoring as well, you know, being yourself, it's so easy to say that. And I'm saying, I'm mentoring a 16-year-old at the moment in Liverpool, and I'm telling her to be herself. And I'm only just about being myself in my 50s. You know, I mean, the cheek of me saying it to her. But, you know, it is.
But it's important to hear that from you. Isn't it? It's important for her to look at you. She no doubt will have you. She will have you on a pedestal, perhaps being a bit nervous, come and talk to you till she's met you, all those things that have gone through her mind. And again, she's taken the brave step to agree to be mentored.
Yeah.
But she's, for her to hear you say that will definitely register with her and definitely help her.
And that's why I do it, I think. And that's why we all need to, if we have time to do mentoring for young people, is that, you know, don't you wish someone had said those things to you? I don't know whether if someone said to me at 16, be yourself, I would have took it on board. But at least it would have made me think, what do you mean? And I say to her, because you're brilliant and you're unique. And, you know, your experience of life might not be perfect, but it's going to help you to understand and be more kind to other people and have empathy. And you'll be so grateful if you get some success, because you know how hard it is, you know, from this background. So I think, I look at the Girls Network, you know what I do, and I think, oh God, I wish I'd had a mentor, because I suppose I might not have left school at 16. I mean, it's worked out, but it's been very long and very painful and very, you know, all those exams and everything. But I just think, you know, wouldn't it would have been nice And I think if they'd have been in my school, I would have signed up for it. Because yes. There was a bit of me that was always ambitious, but it just wasn't around me. You know, mm. The nuns only cared when I got married. You know, mm. My family probably wanted me to go to work so I could, you know, hand up some money. So I think that independent person would be great. And that's why I think it's important and it helps you.
Yeah. And I guess part of what you've just said there about letting go and not caring about what people think, but just being less concerned about people's opinions of you. I'm guessing that's why it explains a lot for your fabulous Twitter feed, which I just go, every time, okay, yeah, I agree with that. Retweet. You're so brave. I mean, I'm a bit of, I've turned into a bit of a retweeter because I'm a bit like, I just love what other people, I love yeah. the way other people phrase things. It can be incredibly yeah. toxic. And I have yeah. to say, I dip very much in and out of,
oh, yeah, me too.
Out of it. But at the same time, it can be incredibly educational as well if you follow yeah. the right people. And, yeah. and you know, particularly just definitely want to give a mention to your work with the fans supporting food banks, because I do have technology for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, use your platform to share that message is full credit to you, to you, Donna, and not only to use the platform, but actually then take action as well. So hugely important to get that message out there that about the vulnerabilities, cost of living, the true impact that, you know, this government is having. We won't get overly political.
No, that'll take another 2 hours.
Yeah, but you know, fair play to you. And I just have to give you kudos for that. You know, as we know, the ultimate aim is to close these food banks down. You know, yes. to not need them. You know, it's a sticking plaster, as they say, on a yes. systemic problem. But yes. I just wanted to give you plaudits for that. And I'm guessing I'm somehow that perhaps is linked to this business about I am going to have my say. I am going to use my voice. And that yes. campaigner that's instinctively in you has become even more strong yes. as you hit midlife and start yes. to know of what people think of you.
And Twitter, I suppose I said earlier, wasn't it? I'm a campaigner by nature, and Twitter is a soapbox. Obviously, it was a better soapbox before Elon got his hands on it, but it's a soapbox. And I suppose I looked at it and thought, this is a place where you can do good. This is a place where you can get a message out. Yes. And but I'm aware. I mean, I don't go on there. I do draft my stuff quite, you know, I think about it. People think and go, do you? It doesn't look like you think about it. I go, no, I do. Of course I do. Yeah. And, you know, I try and research, you know, I try and can back up what I say. Mm-hmm. If it's my opinion, I don't have to. But I just think, and I also think that, you know, I'm in a corporate world. So when yeah. I met Fans Sport and Food Banks years ago, and they're like in their world and they're doing the games and they're, you know, branching out and you know, setting up franchises around the country at other football clubs and in other countries as well. But I was like, you know, I want to introduce you to the legal and the insurance world, because mm-hmm. that'll expand your reach. And, you know, when I first did that, you know, the insurance and legal work were a bit like, oh, food banks. They didn't even want to acknowledge them, that they're there. And I understand that, because they're horrible in the sense that we shouldn't need them. But in another way, they are there and never been more needed. So I kind of use. So I think, and I have said this before as well, that, you know, in an ideal world, I would do any good I do and I wouldn't talk about it. And I wouldn't have it on Twitter and I wouldn't have it on LinkedIn, and I would just do it. A bit like George Michael did, you know, like we never found out how much he did till he died. Mm-hmm. So everyone really would want to be like him. But the fact is that we can, you know, it's funny, Dave Kelly from Fansport Food Banks always goes to me, it's a movement. And yeah. the more people, the bigger that movement, the more people we can help. And he's absolutely right. And he said that to me really early. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to be part of this movement. I know I'm from a different world in terms of being very corporate, but I'm going to do it. And I'm going to stand up and I'm going to do it. And I mean, and when I tell the stories from a Sunday morning and the breakfast, those people have no voice. No. You know, and I hear those stories and they're heartbreaking. And when I put them out, and some of them have gone viral and a lot of donations have come in as a result. And I think, well, you know, we do care. People do care. The response is so big. And, you know, not just like there's comments and the retweets, but also people putting their hand in their pocket and helping food banks who maybe haven't before. And I think, you know, that's the power of social media. There's a horrible side of it. And I hate a lot of it. But I love the good of it.
Yeah,
I think it's the right thing to do.
And Donna, because you know, you say yourself that you're a sort of a natural or born campaigner. That's in your blood. I mean, something like Twitter is something that you're drawn to, because it gives those people you're campaigning for, as you said, a sort of share of the voice, because otherwise their voice wouldn't be heard. What I'm interested, you referred to the fact that you're mentoring somebody who's a 16-year-old. When they look at you and you're talking to them about your experiences and so on, is that the sort of full spectrum of, you know, your experiences as a lawyer and your 29 years and so on, and your experiences, let's say, as a teenager, you're working through that, as well as what you do now on the campaigning side, tweeting?
We do, funny enough, and I love the Girls Network because they give you a range of topics that they suggest to you, but then you get a bit of flexibility around some of the topics. But we just, her and I just did a session on campaigning, on having a purpose and believing in your purpose. And then, you know, and I said, we were talking to her again, and there was suggestions, you know, we had suggestions like Greta, obviously, who's the, there's one end of the spectrum, there's Greta, and then there's like, you know, people. I mean, Michelle Obama was on there, you know, but we were talking about people, and I suppose I'm one of those people. I was laughing to her going, I suppose you'd put me on this list maybe, but you know, so, but I was talking to her and I was saying to her, and she's just presented at school on gender equality. And I sent her some of the stuff from the office and, you know, our gender pay gap recent stuff. And we put some stuff out to give her some research. And, you know, so she's already campaigning. And I was saying to her, you're 16 years old and you're already campaigning because you're, when you had to present at school, you chose gender equality because it's important to you. But I was also saying to her, you know, there's no rush. Take your time, because the thing about putting your voice out there is people will disagree with you. So you've got to build your confidence, do your research. You know, and I said, and try not get angry. You know, we don't all have to agree, and you don't have to agree with me. So, but we had this lovely hour talking about that. Exactly, Patrick. And she got it.
Just what an absolute joy talking to you. We could just keep talking. I knew this would happen. I've got so many more things. I wanted to bring in the boys. I wanted to bring in, just so many other things. Grace Van Owen, I have to talk about
Grace Van Owen.
And Ella, that's LA Law.
LA Law. It was just, I was living in Newcastle, and LA Law and 30 something were the big programs.
30 something
and LA Law were brilliant. Yes. So this was going on, and I was working a legal aid practice above Samuel the Jewelers in top of the big market, or bottom of the big, I don't know how they say it there, top, anyway, near the big market. So it was not plush. And I was going out like to the police station in the middle of the night. So there was nothing glamorous about that job. I had to see 6 clients every afternoon. I was run ragged. So then I go to London to Miss Condorea, and I get my, I'm a secretary. Then I'm a trainee legal exec, and I get to share a room with the woman who gave me the job, and our big glass room with our names on the door. You know, when you go, and I just thought, shit, I am Grace Van Owen. This is it. And I even like wine. Now, she liked it a bit more than me in the programme. But, you know, but honestly, I went home and I said to my brother, oh, my God. You know, and he said, don't be losing the run of yourself here. You know, it's only a glass office and a name. But, yeah. Michelle, I imagined LA Law.
Yes. You've got to tell your story now.
Well, my mum thought I was LA Law, and I laughed one day. I was sent to, we were representing Knowsley Council, and it was a claim for, and I've never forgotten the term, leptospirosis. It makes me sound really clever, but it's basically rat's urine. Okay. And he was claiming that they caught this disease because there was rats in at this abattoir that belonged to Knowsley Council. And I was sent on a site inspection. Now, I don't know if you know Charles Feeney. He's one of the tallest, poshest, probably, barristers in Liverpool. And we rock up to this, and we have to put the hair nets on, the white suit, the whole thing. And the next thing, I'm walking around in pig swill. And I'm like, my mum thinks I'm Grace Van Outen.
Not today. Oh, my God.
I had to leave. I had to run out. I was like, "Give me some air." And I was like,
"You know when you're gagging?" Oh no! Like,
just give him the money. Thank you for being such a wonderful guest.
Thank you. And it's amazing when you approached me. I mean, I was like, me, and there is always that thing, isn't there? You're still that girl, you know, thinking, but because I'm a big admirer, and you know, I've listened to your stuff, and it's just great. So I thank you very much. And it's quite therapeutic to go over it a bit. And now the Tori Molina story is out there, so everyone
love it.
The holiday romance.
Never knock those holiday romances. No. I'm telling you, yeah, there's definitely a book in there.
There is. Yeah, I'm not writing it, so someone else will have to do it. Oh, thank you very much. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Connor.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Talk On to Walk On podcast, which is just one part of our wider offer. Our mission is to remind the world that conversations should never be underestimated. But we also know that many conversations need a lot of courage and confidence. That's why Patrick and I have created Elevate Your Mindset under the Talk On to Walk On brand. If you think you, your team, or your students would enjoy working with us to walk on in life with confidence, then go to our website, talkontowalkon.com. You'll learn more about us, our coaching, mentoring, and talks offer. You can also follow Talk On to Walk on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Finally, taking a moment to rate, review, and subscribe or even sponsor our podcast will really help us spread our power of conversation message. Remember, the simplest act can have the largest impact. So let's connect, have a conversation, and you never know where it will lead.